All right, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the members section. We really appreciate having you with us. We're talking with Danny Wilton, and we are continuing discussing his book, Orion in the Vatican. Fascinating topic. There's a lot of material here that we have yet to get to. So we're going to enjoy the second hour, I believe. There's so many interesting aspects, Danny, that we can go into and discuss, and we'll try to check some off here in the second hour. What about the Orion Nebula versus what NASA has been talking about? Because you mentioned something before about this being kind of a stellar nursery, if you will. And what's interesting about that is yet again, we go back to how the heck did the ancient people knew that this was the source of where this was coming from? But some new research is coming out now that basically is kind of confirming this, if you will. So tell us about NASA's take on the Orion Nebula.
Well, I started doing some research into the stars in Orion, because, you know, in our biblical text, it says in Amos 5:8, it says, "Seek him that made the stars in Orion and Pleiades." And so the first thing that came to mind when I viewed Amos 5:8 was that the most logical place to make stars in Orion would be the Orion Nebula. You know, we can see traces of this when we take a look at the Barnard's Loop, which are these this loop that travels the whole constellation, and we can see stars like Betelgeuse and Rigel, and these various stars seem like that they're traveling outside of this. It's like they're moving from the Orion's Loop to where their current location is. But we know that the center of that is where the Orion Nebula is. We can clearly see that when we just put a Fibonacci spiral on top of the whole constellation. So I started looking into the stars of Orion because of that biblical text, and what I found is that Orion, the NASA says that the Orion Nebula is about 3 million years old, to me this doesn't logically make sense based on the other stars where they have given them ages. Now, according to the electrical universe theory, you can't put an age on a star, and whether that's true or not, NASA decided to put ages on these various stars, going from Bellatrix, which is the closest to us, and then Betelgeuse, and then Cygnus, and then Rigel, and so forth. And what we notice about these is that Bellatrix is about 25 million years old, according to NASA. And as we move from Bellatrix all the way to the Orion Nebula, if we use a graph, and there's a photo I have in my Facebook that shows age versus distance. So the age of the star from, and then the distance of it from the Earth. And what we see is that these stars, in a very smooth line, continue to get younger as they go all the way to the Orion Nebula, which means that logically, it makes sense that the Orion Nebula produced these stars. Otherwise, they wouldn't increasingly get younger. Because if we look at the whole Orion constellation at an angle from where we're looking at the side of it, the stars look a lot different. When we look up into the sky, we're seeing them all as the Orion constellation. But looking at it from a side view, you can see the different distances as they move towards the Orion Nebula. And they all get younger in a very smooth line based on age versus distance. So to me, that means one of two things. Either it means that the Orion Nebula spit the stars out into the Orion constellation, or that the Orion Nebula was moving across the sky and dropped them along the way. Mm-hmm. The second seems to make more sense, because we see that there's a Barnard's Loop that seems to start where Bellatrix is, and it starts circling around, and you can see how it covers the whole Orion constellation, ending at the Orion Nebula. So, to me, logically, it makes sense that the Orion Nebula created those stars in Orion. And if it did, and we see this biblical text saying, "Seek him that made the stars in Orion and the Pleiades," well, there seems to be some kind of an interesting connection there. And there's more interesting connections. So I disagree with NASA on the stars in Orion Nebula. And you know, they're always changing their story anyway. They use a lot of math, but it seems like they always change their equations anyway. And the funny thing about the whole age of stars, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but NASA just realized that these what they use, which are radioactive isotopes, in order to age these stars, they realized that the sun not too long ago is putting out these interesting particles that are changing the half-life of these isotopes, which means they can throw away what they believe the age of some of these things to be, because obviously the sun is changing the half-life of these things.
Yeah, so. Isn't that amazing? It would turn some things really upside down, and we don't know what is going to be guiding, what the rule point is, I guess we could say, because we're looking and trying to find laws to be able to determine, you know, reality, where we are, what's going on, and everything else. But if it's indeed something that now then is being upset, it's almost like literally the matrix that you talked about before, where the emanation coming from the construction or the creation, if you will, of the universe, is altering the fundamental laws of physics, is like being modified for some reason, and we don't know why, you know.
Right. I think the more that we start digging into it, the more we are going to realize that our whole universe is this mental creation. We keep trying to put everything in a box, and I think that what we're going to learn over time is that we can't do that. Things are not just going to follow these universal laws every time they believe it. Because every time they come up with something, they have to come up with a paradox that puts a Band-Aid on what they on all the things that that show differences compared to what they came up with. For example, let's talk about these images around the Nile that are matching the Orion Nebula Trapezium. So if and they're man-made recent developments. So if we were to snap a picture of the Orion Nebula, then that means that according to the laws of physics that we have today, that means we're looking into the past about 1,300 or 1,400 years, since the Orion Nebula is about 1,300 or 1,400 light years away. So even if it is mimicking what is here on Earth, or even if there is some kind of, quote, conspiracy, which I don't believe there is, about why it's mimicking this stuff on Earth or why Earth is mimicking it, if that were the case, if it was some kind of a conspiracy, then the laws of physics would not apply, because it would have had to have known about it, 1,300 or 1,400 years ago, in which time these pieces of land didn't exist on the planet, these areas that are mimicking the Orion Nebula. So given that they're probably no older than about 500 years old, then when we think about that as compared to how long it takes light to get here, according to the theory of relativity, then it doesn't add up. Mm-hmm. It seems to be instantaneous, whatever we're seeing out there. So whatever we snapped a picture of is already sitting here on Earth. This gets into this matrixy kind of thing, and I think what we're going to find over time is that the universe and physical reality as we understand it is not what we think it is.
Do you think
this
it's
is
a,
what hermetics?
Exactly. Do you think it's a what should we call it? A play, somewhat of a game, that it's also it's dependent on the observer, of course, but also what we focus on, what we do, what we envision, etc. Anywhere we could go with this is having an effect out there in the so-called real world, in the physical world out there, that what we perceive to be the correct answer, let's say, is something that we are going to find out there. Our expectation is kind of what is running things. So there is a reverse thing we can look at here as well.
Well, what I find, I find that science keeps confirming over and over hermetic philosophy. You know, one of the principles in hermetic philosophy is that everything moves, everything vibrates. This was in 1960s, I believe, NASA came out with their, or the science came out with string theory, that everything moves, everything vibrates. There's this these things that are happening over and over where science continually confirms hermetics. Now, one of the things in hermetics that we see is that it specifically says that the universe is mental, held in the mind of the all, which means that what everybody considers to be God is really, when we think about it, it is everything. It's everything around us. It's you, it's me, it's all of our thoughts, it's everything that we touch, it's the tree outside, it's the grass on the ground, it's everything. Everything is all God. And so when we think of it that way, the hermetics describes it as if it wants to create something, since it can't duplicate itself, since it is everything, what it actually does is go within itself to create. And it does this mentally because it can't create something extra that's physically because it already is everything. So the bottom line is that everything is consciousness. It's all, and what physical reality actually is it is a mental creation at a lower vibration. So Hermetics actually goes into the idea that there's three great planes. There's the physical plane, the mental plane, and the spiritual plane. And that they're basically all the same. It's just that what we consider to be physical reality is a lower vibration of all of that. So everything ultimately would be consciousness. And there is no separate God from a separate devil. It's all part of the same God. It's all part of the same thing. It's all within the same mind. And it's just like your fingers aren't separate from your body. They're part of your body, just like we are part of the whole containment of what is considered to be God. So, and then when people understand that we're all connected that way, I think when that's understood and that we shouldn't treat everything as being separate, that things will be a little bit better around here. But that's my perception of reality. I believe it's all a mental creation, and it is kind of a play. In a way, and the whole purpose of the play would be to increase consciousness and to learn. And this is, I believe, what the ancient Egyptians believed also.
Very good. Let's talk about some of the other, I guess we can call them, powerful symbols that you've found in the nebula, depicted in the art, etc. We can go through things like the all-seeing eye or the tetragrammaton, the Holy Trinity, the winged disc, wherever you'd like to start, Danny.
Sure. We can talk about the winged disc. It's a very interesting one. The winged disc, we see that in cultures in ancient Sumeria. We see it in Babylonia. We see it in Sumeria. We see it across culture. And most typically, even in Zoroastrian, what we see is this figure inside of a winged disc, like a man that's part of this winged disc holding a ring in front of him. And so when we look into the ancient Sumerian culture, we normally see this god, sometimes he's called Ashur, sometimes he's called Asari, sometimes he's called Asar, which is actually the ancient Egyptian version of Osiris. What we find out is that even through E.A. Wallace Budge and his interpretations of Osiris and what Osiris means is that when he looked across these cultures, that he found that Asari and Marduk and all these gods were basically the same as Osiris based on their etymology and so forth. Well, when we see them depicted here, we always see them depicted on top of this tree of life. So you see this tree, and then at the very top of the tree, floating above the tree, you see this winged disc and this guy that's inside of this winged disc facing to the right. And then you see these Sumerian, I don't know if we want to call them gods or what have you, but what they're doing is they're all staring at the winged disc, and then several of them are holding these pine cones up to it. And when we look into the ancient history and what we see that there is this relationship between the pine cone and the pineal gland. And so it's logical that when we take a look at the winged disc, and the pine cones that are being presented to it, that there is a relationship between the winged disc and the pineal gland or the pine cone that we see. We even see the winged disc in ancient Egypt. As they walk into the temples, the winged disc is displayed above the door, which is a representation of the central pineal gland. So, interestingly, when we look into the infrared version of the Orion Nebula, we see a very clear image of the same winged disc that we see from Far Bahar, from ancient Sumerians, even down to a man facing to the right, holding a ring in front of him. It's so highly detailed. And what I think that makes this extremely significant is that it is to such a level of detail that you can see that this universe, the universe or this area, is communicating with some kind of symbolism. And when we flip the image from the infrared version, where this winged disc is located, over to the full color visual version, We see that in the full color version that this represents the trapezium and the pineal gland. And when we see that this area of the Orion Nebula represents a whole brain and these various parts of the brain, that's exactly where the pineal gland is once again. And this confirms itself when we see this and these pine cones being held to it on top of the tree. So there's this symbolic writing that nature is providing this way.
What can you say about the tetragrammaton, or the all-seeing eye, the triangle with the kind of the blazing rays coming out behind it? I mean, I think one of the earliest depictions, and I might be wrong on this, but I think it goes back to the cathedral at Aachen, you know, in Germany, or Aachen. Visited mm-hmm. there, what is now, 2 years ago almost soon. Beautiful cathedral. It's just stunning there. It's from Charlemagne's era, of course. And this has one of these on the outside when you kind of walk into the courtyard, shall we say. And to many people today, it's like a symbol associated with the Illuminati and everything else. But the fact is, this is a representational symbol of the Holy Trinity, of God. And sometimes you have the Jewish letters written within there for Yahweh and stuff like that. But what's the Orion connection to this symbol?
Well, so for your listeners, we have had the unfortunate experience of having various cultures take these ancient symbols and steal them and turn them into something that's bad. For example, the swastika is found all over antiquity, and yet the Nazis in Nazi Germany, they stole that symbol and they used it for something completely different. The same thing happened with the all-seeing eye, the Eye of Providence. And there is a very interesting picture that I have where it is basically just showing lines that swirl into the middle like a vortex. And if you blur that image, just blur it over and over again, what's actually created is a perfectly shaped eye. If anybody's familiar with the eye of the storm terminology, you know, the eye that's in the center of a hurricane.
Yeah,
it represents a vortex, and we see this all over nature. We even see it on the poles of Saturn. And I even interviewed the guys from the Electric Universe. I think it was Wal Thornhill. We had him on, and they had talked about Saturn and that being related to the all-seeing eye. But it's actually just a more generic way of realizing it has something to do with the vortex. And we see that the vortex, or the whirlwind, is a symbol of spirit inside the Bible. Now, the relationship to Osiris, excuse me, is E.A. Wallace Budge, when he deciphered the hieroglyph for Osiris. If you've ever seen Osiris hieroglyph, it is an eye, and it's a throne that's sitting right in front of the eye. And so what E.A. Wallace Budge deciphered, Osiris, is an eye in a throne, or an eye in a tent. That's the way he deciphered it. And so when we see an eye on a throne, and we take a look at the human body once again, what the eye on the throne actually is, it's the pineal gland sitting on top of the brainstem right behind the thalamus, tucked in between the two angels, which is also very similar to the Ark of the Covenant. When we take a look at the tetragrammaton, the symbol for Yahweh, and we look into these churches, we find that the Ark of the Covenant, which are these two angels, and we see Yahweh, the tetragrammaton, the sun that's in between the two angels, sitting on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And this is very obvious when you look at it, that when you look at the Ark of the Covenant, you're looking at a part of the human body where the two angels are the right and left thalamus, and the Yahweh symbol, the sun, is the pineal gland in between the two, sitting on top of the throne or on top of the Ark. And then, of course, that seems to represent a vortex. It's the eye, an eye on top of a throne. And it's an eye and a tent. And this is the exact same symbolism that we see inside the center of the Orion Nebula.
Interesting. Now, if we talk about some of the artists again, Bernini, Michelangelo, Brunelleschi, El Greco, you mentioned, these seem to be then, well, we could view them, I guess, still as kind of divinely inspired artists. And what's interesting about this is that it's carrying on as well in modern times, if you will, or up to now. I think there's several people who have kind of followed in that tradition, if you will. I don't know how much you've looked into that, but one of them that you bring up, and she's not an artist per se, but she's a visionary. She's called Ellen G. White. You wrote about her in the book a little bit about her experiences as a, I guess, medium or something like that. Tell us about her and what she said about Orion.
Well, first of all, a lot of people give her a hard time, and I think they do. I think they make personal attacks without seeing the consistency of her visions with what we've seen. Ellen G. White, having done the Orion research that I had, was right on target. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with what her gravestone looks like, but it's actually an obelisk. And so her gravestone is an obelisk. But she mentioned some very interesting things. She was the creator of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And there was a, she had about 2,000 visions between the time she was 17 until the time she died. And one of them was the opening heavens, is what it's called. And she was, I forget the guy's name, but he was asking her, he was an astronomer, I believe, and he was asking her about, and she was going through the planets. In other words, in her vision, she was going through the planets of the solar system. And then at the very end of the solar system, after she had gone past Saturn, then she reached the Orion Nebula. Now, when we take a look at the history of Jacob's ladder, you know, the ancient Egyptians and the tale of Muhammad and him traveling, and then there's Ishtar, who came down from the seven gates that they came down. All these tales of the stories of the ladder going through the planets and going, and even if you take a look at the alchemical drawings from Athanasius Kircher and these other various people that were really into alchemy back in the 1500s, 1600s, there's this common pattern of them depicting the various planets, and after you reach Saturn, at the very end of it, you reach the opening of heaven. So there was this understanding that the solar system a long time ago by the ancients was a representation of metaphysical man as he moved, I guess, similar to the chakra system. And then reaching the very end, even Manly Hall goes into this, and he uses the terminology interchangingly between Jesus and Osiris. It represents the area called the Christ, and he calls, and since we know the ancient Egyptians realized that Osiris was this area of the cosmos, when we hear Ellen G. White talk about the this area where she moved, and then she saw this area called the opening heavens, and she said that Christ would come through the Orion Nebula, and that's basically what her story was. So her story is consistent with the story of the ladder. Jacob's ladder, Muhammad's ladder, all these various things, all the way back to ancient Egypt. Now, and the story of the ladder began in ancient Egypt, where it said that they said that they would go upon the staff. It says, "I have gone up by the means of the staff, which is in the place where the soul is found. I've gone upon the ladder with my foot on Orion and my arm uplifted." That's Pyramid Text 625. So this story of the ladder goes all the way back to ancient Egypt, and it always seems to be where Orion is, and this is what we see. And when we see that inside the Church of the Jesu, the painting of the fresco that is the triumph of the name of Jesus, we see the whole Orion's loop almost acting as this ladder, because we see all these people riding the clouds and circling all the way into heaven on this fresco, which seems to show the same thing as the ladder. So I believe that Ellen G. White was extremely consistent in her story and understanding, as all of these others that had the same vision, from Jacob to Muhammad to the story of Ishtar and so on, and all the way back to ancient Egypt. She was very consistent.
I think many of these people are being attacked, if you will, then, because they have more of an open esoteric interpretation of some of this stuff, and people find clues within their work, I guess, to the fact that it has the roots to the esoteric tradition, and therefore, of course, they're being pointed out as being Luciferian Satanists, you know, whatever you want to call it.
So,
so that's unfortunate, I guess.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but you know, we've got, I mean, these artists are showing, there's these various archetypes that keep coming out, and the archetypes are the winged disc, the trapezium area, the whirlwind or the vortex, and all of these seem to be consistent, and they seem to be confirming each other, and they all seem to have something to do with the mind and the soul, and even Gustave Dore, which was the divine, the guy who did a lot of the paintings for Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
When we see him standing there with Beatrice, looking at heaven, what they're actually looking at, they're looking at the same thing. They're looking at all these angels circling around this bright spot, this vortex, which looks very similar to the pole on Saturn, and it also looks very similar to the very center of the Orion Nebula. The interesting thing about the story of the latter is that when they reached Saturn or they reached the edge of the solar system, that there was this ladder that went from the solar system to the fixed stars. Well, these vortexes, apparently, I've been doing some thinking and contemplating about this, but what if these vortexes are some kind of a stargate of some sort that take you from one place to the next? There's all kinds of interesting things that we can think about on this. I believe Nassim Haramein had gone into the idea that there were these, these vortexes or these singularities inside the sun, where these guys could go from the sun to, say, the center of the galaxy as a hub, and then they could go back to any of the other stars they wanted to through the center of the sun. And I found that very interesting as well.
Let's cover this next part a little bit here, because there might be some people at this stage then who's looking at the material. There are looking at the Orion Nebula, and they just think, well, you can find anything in there. This is like if you're looking into the clouds, you can find faces and shapes and everything. And this is just what the brain does. It makes things up. It's seeking pattern, blah blah blah. And you cover this a little bit in the beginning of the book as well. Tell us about this and what your take on that is. Pareidolia, I think it's called.
Yeah, pareidolia. Well, okay. So pareidolia is first of all, no, it is a it's an inconclusive, and in my opinion, it's a pseudoscience. The whole definition behind pareidolia is that somebody sees random. Or things that they see random things that are significant or meaningful. Well, in order for that to be a truth, then that means that the person who is performing the test gets to decide when something becomes meaningful or not.
That's right.
Now, a good example of this would be if you've ever seen an autostereogram. It's basically, it looks like a bunch of random dots on a page. But if you look at it correctly, and if you use your eyes correctly, it actually turns into a 3D image. Have you ever seen one of those?
Oh, sure. They're pretty trippy.
Right. So now, if you could imagine that nobody was aware of this technology, and somebody said that they could see something in that, then somebody could just as easily say that was pareidolia when it's and clearly has an intelligible image inside it, if you know how to look at it correctly. But beyond pareidolia, we're not really dealing with pareidolia, because pareidolia is, even though it is inconclusive and cannot be diagnosed, the only person that can determine whether they're experiencing pareidolia or not is not the person giving the test, but the person experiencing the phenomena. Because nobody can tell you when something what you're seeing is meaningful. The only person that can determine that is you.
That's right.
But beyond pareidolia, we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with what's called pattern matching, and that's completely different. Pareidolia is like an inkblot test. It's like, what do you see in this? But that's not what we're dealing with. What we're dealing with actually is repeatable data, and we're dealing with what's called pattern matching, which means we already have an image to look at, and we're comparing it against what we're seeing out there. And so that's completely different from pareidolia, and that's what a lot of people need to understand. Pareidolia also deals with very simple images. It deals with, for example, the typical thing they use is a face. And in fact, if you go to Wikipedia and you type in pareidolia, the first thing that they show you is the face on Mars. I think
it's hilarious. Yeah.
I think that what was his name? Well, who's the guy that did all the study on that?
Oh, Hoagland, Richard C. Hoagland.
Yes, Richard Hoagland. I don't know why I couldn't think of that all of a sudden, but yeah, I'm sure he would be really happy to see that that was posted out there as an example of pareidolia.
That's right.
But what they use, here's another example. So what they call pareidolia is they show you a circle with two holes and a line underneath it that would actually produce a face. But say now that we have a yellow circle with two eyes and we have a curve underneath it with dimples. Now that's not pareidolia anymore, that's a smiley face. And so why is it a smiley face and not pareidolia at that point? So there's all kinds of questions about this. There's all kinds of gray areas that you go into where, is this something that I'm seeing or is it not something I'm seeing? And you can see where the problem starts arising because people just as a knee-jerk reaction begin, they just use it as something like, oh, it's just pareidolia, you know, you're diagnosed, and this is not the case. What we're actually seeing out here, we're seeing pattern matching, but there is symbolic stuff that's out here too, but there gets to be a point where it's so highly detailed. And for example, one of the things I have out there that I found is this red dragon. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, definitely. I went through it in the book. It's really interesting. Tell us about this, where it shows up in the nebula.
Well, there's the very center of the nebula out there. When we look at it as the brain, it would be the very part of the frontal lobe of the brain. But with one click of the mouse, you can go out there and you can expose what this red dragon. And I highly recommend everybody go and check this out on my Facebook. But it's so highly detailed, Henrik, that there's no way that something like that can be classified as pareidolia when you take a look at what they classify as pareidolia. I mean, at some point you have to go, wow, this is a real image that we're seeing out here. And
yeah,
there's all kinds of holographic. The Orion Nebula is not like any other nebula you've ever seen. When you look into the holographic interpretations that are going on out there, it's just absolutely amazing, even down to hand and arm bones and vertebrae and stuff like that. It's almost like body parts are stacked all over each other. So it's just really an interesting place to take a look at. But the red dragon is very good. The winged disc is very good. But all of these things, in the majority of the cases, seem to confirm each other over the other data that we find in these various cathedrals and all the way back to ancient Egypt and so forth. The pattern matching is there. So it's clearly not a question of pareidolia. What we're talking about is highly detailed pattern matching, and that's something completely different altogether.
Well, this so-called quote-unquote scientific approach that they have lack, I think, a deeper understanding of the interaction quality, if you will, as well. That, just as you said, Danny, it's not an external judge that comes into the picture and tells you this is meaningful and this is not. And you say, why? Well, because I say so. That's basically the premise that they're working on.
Exactly. And that breaks the scientific method, because the whole point behind the scientific method is to be able to present a test that's not biased. But it's completely biased when you tell somebody, oh, what you're seeing is random or meaningless, because you can't do that. I mean, and there was also, in the test that they performed, there was never this gray area where they slightly, say they moved from a wall socket that looks like a face. Well, they didn't go to something that maybe the next step up, which might have been some clip art that looks like a really bad picture. Or then, you know, maybe the next step would be like a fuzzy photo and things like that. And I've done research all the way to MIT, and, they wrote an article about face recognition, 20 things that people that do face recognition programming should understand. And they went into the whole idea about what humans can recognize, and a human can recognize a face no matter whether it's really fuzzy or not, or things like that. So we have the capability to do things that are beyond what computers can, at least right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's another thing. If we go to teneye.com, for example, say you want to find, you have a photo on your computer, and you want teneye to be able to find that same photo out there. So you can submit that photo to this application that's on the internet, and it will find everything out there that looks very similar to it. And what you'll find is that if we submitted a photo of creation of Adam, for example, it's going to find all these variations, even things that may have substitute Adam for somebody else, that's something that's kind of funny or comical or whatever, but it definitely finds the same picture. So if a computer can do that, a human can do that. Mm. And people don't realize that humans have very great ability to be able to do complex pattern recognition. But what happens a lot is that people just get into this knee-jerk reaction of saying pareidolia when they don't really know what they're talking about. This is about complex pattern matching and things like that.
Yep, I agree. I mean, the excuse is to say, well, the brain is, you know, wired to find these patterns. It's an ancient thing, basically, you know, dealt with the possibility that when you're out running around in the jungle, you want to be able to determine, is there a tiger behind that bush or not? You know, that kind of thinking. So that you can see, determine, oh, shit, it is a tiger, you know, run up in the tree, whatever, what have you. But just because there is a pattern in someone's opinion doesn't mean that there isn't anything valuable in that. I mean, look at some of the other images that have been coming out that they've discovered through Hubble, for instance. You have this hand reaching out, looks like a perfect
human hand.
Yeah,
the hand of God, I've seen that. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. That's a pretty interesting picture. I think the latest one they found was this manatee-looking nebula. But yeah, there's all kinds of interesting things. But what we have to look at, though, is we kind of have to look at the whole study here, because the whole study that's being done here is that there is an unbelievable amount of repeatability that goes along with the study that, for example, that I've been performing, and there's the same patterns keep coming out all along, even to geography on the planet. And all of the data that's being presented confirms itself over and over again. We can see how they interconnect. And so if somebody's just viewing the material for the first time, you know, actually the book is the best way to at least get a good start. You know, there's been some research that has been done since the book, and you can get that at orionandthevatican.com. It's a $10 ebook. But if you'll look at the book first and review all the material, you'll begin to see how it all interconnects and how repeatable it is. And that's where we start really seeing the scientific part of this coming out, because it's not something that's just a one-off, like, oh, I just saw this face in the cloud. What we're seeing is a pattern, and that this pattern keeps repeating itself over and over in all of this art, and just all over the place, all the way back to Egypt. And I think that makes all this very significant when we take a look at it that way.
Indeed, there are very interesting images in the book that details this, that again goes from the original, if you will, from the artist over to the nebula, or reverse, from the nebula over to the artist. And you've zoomed, what you've done as well, we can detail that, I guess, for people who don't haven't looked at some of the images yet, is you zoom in on certain sections of the nebula and then find correlations in some of the images that you've analyzed. Do you think that there is are you continuing to finding other artists that have the same you know, imagery in them, or do you think that this could just go on and on and on, basically, for you?
There's a couple of things I key in on. You know, as I said, the Orion Nebula Trapezium, the very center part, seems to be airing itself over and over again, and so that's the area that I can immediately spot it. And yeah, I am continuing to find things, but I kind of started putting it down. I kept finding so many of the same exact pattern, the same theme, you know, and we see that this, even when we go back to the pyramid text, what I just read to you earlier about how they were going up into Orion with their arm uplifted. This is the exact same theme that we keep seeing over and over in all these paintings, where Jesus is ascending up into the Orion Nebula Trapezium with his arms uplifted. Mm-hmm. It's in all of these paintings all over the place. So, yeah, it just keeps coming up all over, but what I have found so far, my latest research has been to, and you should go check it out, Henrik, some pretty amazing stuff, but I started going in and dissecting the various parts of the brain inside the Orion Nebula, and I even have some overlays with a real brain versus what we see out there in the Orion Nebula, and I have found the cerebellum, the pons, the midbrain, the pituitary, the ventricles, the corpus callosum, all of these areas of the frontal lobe, all of this, it's all out there. And the very significant part is the trapezium, exactly where the pineal gland is located. And proportionally to the human brain and where all of these parts are, it is absolutely amazing. They all seem to fall right in line exactly where everything is, and they are all proportional.
Tell us about the Pleiades as well and how that ties into it.
Well, the Pleiades, you know, and of course in the Bible it says that that seek him that made the Orion and the Pleiades, and it also speaks of the what it speaks of, and when we even take a look at some of the people who have analyzed Ellen G. White's work, and they have analyzed the Orion Nebula and this stuff biblically, is that, you know, the Pleiades seem to, all the stars seem to be held together. And it seems like they're being held together consciously, because it speaks in the Bible of the ability to be able to loosen the bands of Orion, or loosen the stars, or make them, you know, either separate or tighten or what have you. And it speaks of the same type of thing with the Pleiades. And so it seems as though these stars are being consciously controlled in some way by this nebula. Now, as far as the Pleiades goes, the Seven Sisters, I'm not as familiar with them. I know there is a tie to the Mayans as far as the Pleiades go, but as far as the area of creation and the three hearthstones, which I never hear anybody talk about, and it's so important, the area of creation that's so important, and the resurrection of the maize god is right in the center.
You did have a quote from Carl Johan Kellerman, though, in the book as well. He actually details this a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That talks about the center point of creation. I guess he as well says, though, that it's it is a speculation at that point, but it could be that this is the center emanation where it's coming from. And I'm trying to find this right now in the book as well, so I can just read what it says here, because it's a pretty interesting one. Yeah, he says, one ancient Mayan myth talks about the heart of the cosmos being located in the midst of the three heart stones in the direction of the sword in the constellation of Orion.
Carl Kellerman had put that on his side as well. The direction of Orion's sword in the middle of the three hearthstones, exactly. It's the area where the fire and the hearth is, which, and it says here in the Popol Vuh, it says, proven to be the first Maya creation myth since the pre-classic. And it says in this book, Orion was seen as the first father, who was known as the Hun-Hunapu, the maize god, the father of the hero twins. That were fundamental in their mythology. And so when we take a look at this kind of stuff, it seems to be in parallel. The maize god, you know, this is just like Osiris was as well. So
yeah.
As far as the Pleiades goes, I know there's some connection there and stuff to the Mayans. And the Pleiades was, I think there was a, earlier this, was it last year, the Pleiades was aligned, I believe, to the sun, and the Mayans had said something about how it was going to be providing various energies and stuff to us. I'm not really sure, but haven't really gotten into that area of it as much.
What do you think about Orion being a source of, guidance or transformation, or that it's like a center point that actually dictates, if you will, at least the universe that we can see? I mean, I think Ellen G. White wrote about it as well, that this is connected to the second coming. And again, you gave us your take on what Jesus is in your view. So it's not the literal interpretation of a man coming in that sense. It's about a shift in consciousness, etc. But there is a kind of not a doomsday thing associated with it, but almost like a little fear that the booming voice of God is like coming out from Orion. This is...
Let me read that to you, because here's the interesting thing about it too. If there is a vortex or a black hole, as NASA calls it, we don't really know what the functionality of what that thing is. They have their idea. The Electric Universe has their theories, but we don't really know. And she says this. She says that I'll just read it. It says, I saw that when the Lord said heaven in giving signs recorded by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he meant heaven. When he said earth, he meant earth. The powers of the heaven are the sun, moon, and stars. They rule in the heavens. The powers of earth are those that rule on the earth. The powers of the heaven will be shaken at the voice of God. Then the sun, the moon, and the stars will be moved out of their places. They will not pass away, but be shaken by the voice of God.
Yeah.
Dark, heavy clouds came up and clashed against each other. The atmosphere parted and rolled back, and then we could look up through the open space in Orion, which came the voice of God. And so the holy city will come down through that open space. Now, that can be interpreted a lot of different ways. But it appears that as though there could be something physical as well attached to this. It seems that though she is mentioning that there is something physical that's going to take place as well. And what she mentions is that, this is interesting, because she says that, I saw the powers of earth are now being shaken and events come in order. And this is really interesting right here. She says, war and rumors of war, sword, famine, and pestilence are first to shake the powers of earth. And then she says, I saw that the shaking of the powers in Europe is not as some teach, the shaking of powers of heaven, but as the shaking of the angry nations.
Mm-hmm.
And based on what we see going on around around the times right now, I think it's kind of interesting that she mentioned some of this stuff. And so she sounds like she's talking about something physical. Who knows? Maybe this this vortex wakes up. Because when we see in the Bible, you know, we see in the Bible that it mentions in Revelations how this this the Son of Man in the midst of the seven candlesticks. Well, there's seven stars in Orion, and in the very midst of those seven stars is the Son of Man, which means like man. It talks about him waking up, and I believe that it's almost like this area is a reflection of us, perhaps. When we wake up, it wakes up. Or when it wakes up, we wake up. I don't know which way it goes, but it almost seems like it's a mirror of us or something.
Yeah, interesting. Tell us about the Hall of Records. What do you think that could be?
Well, the Hall of Records is also mentioned as the Akashic Records. It's kind of used interchangeably a lot if you've been to... CrystalLinks.com, we've been to some of these other areas, we see that these areas seem to be tied to each other. Akashic means sky. And so what we see that's going on out there is this area of information. It provides us all of this information, either symbolically or, and it records things, which is what the Akashic Records does. So you know, there's some believe that the Akashic or that the Hall of Records is located under the paw of the Sphinx. Some believe that they're never going to find it because it has something to do with something that you you reach in a higher state of consciousness. What I believe that this area out there, according to Walter Russell as well, that this area out there records information and contains all of this information that. Perhaps it records history of mankind all the way back to when we started. And if this is the case, then what I'm actually doing is not probably the best way to view the information. And it would be like the difference between really experiencing it, which I believe the ancient Egyptians did, versus looking through the outside of a database into various data and trying to make something out of it, which is kind of what I'm doing right now. I think the ancient Egyptians were actually able to tap into this kind of stuff, and this would be like the Hall of Records, which contained all this information as well as the Akashic Records.
What does this all, I guess, lead to or even mean in your opinion, Danny? I mean, is this about a greater realization of what we're part of, what the source is, maybe how we can affect it or influence it, or how we can turn it into, let's say, something we... enjoy versus just being slaves to the consequences that are seems to be happening to us. What's the greater meaning in this? Do you think
the greater meaning to me is that when I take a look at what I have learned so far, basically compared to what I see people struggling with, I see that what has happened in society is that we have been locked into this left brain only world. and that people have remained half conscious. They've remained disconnected to nature and to higher forms of consciousness. And the greater meaning that I'm finding behind all this is that there's something beyond NASA. There's something beyond this left brain world where something doesn't fold into the current the current model that you throw it away. What I think we need, and what I think we lost a long time ago when we moved from hieroglyphics and so forth into a words and language structure, is we lost a lot of right brain expression. I think we lost the ability to be able to communicate with nature, and I think this is one of the things that the ancient Egyptians did, is they were able to communicate and with nature and understand the what nature was. They were more one with nature, and because of that, they were higher level of consciousness, and perhaps exhibited. Maybe they were able to tap into areas that allowed them to do things like build these pyramids. You know, the whole idea behind the pyramids and the initiation of the pyramid was to understand that consciousness goes beyond this physical reality. And and so I think that the real lesson to be learned here is that we need to gain back some of our right brain expression, yeah, and understand that the universe actually does communicate. And I'm showing that it's actually communicating in hieroglyphics. There's so much of an area of consciousness beyond what NASA teaches us and what we learn in school. And I think if we can get some of that back, I think we'll be in a much better place. And one of the things I'm attempting to do with all of this is to help people by giving them things that they can tangibly see and understand, and then hopefully over time they'll be able to connect all this stuff together. And trying to show them the parallels and show them that there's a million different religions out there. God isn't a Christian. He's not a Jew. He's not a Muslim. He's none of those. And so the idea that you can't look beyond what you have been taught in your own religious organization is ridiculous. You have to, if you want to be fully conscious, you have to look at the data everywhere. And I think that, and that goes for science. Science needs to connect the religious or the spiritual aspects again. You know, when we look into alchemy and we look into what was really important, it was a balance of the left and the right brain. It was a balance of the heart and the left and the right brain. And all those together caused the birth of the divine child. If you're all left, you're nothing but a robot. And if you're all right, your head's in the clouds. You have to have a balance of the two. And I think that's what we've lost.
Very good. As Jordan Maxwell brilliantly said as well. He said, God is greater than anyone of us can imagine. It's a bigger concept, pretty much. And I think it's also about the realization, Danny, that the universe is alive. It's not dead. We have become, or we have to become alive, rather, wake up from being dead ourselves and realize that it's we who find and give meaning to the things that are around us. It is not going to arrive at us and tell us, all right, this is meaningful for you, or this is not, you know, whatever. We are, in that sense, we are the creators. We are the ones who we give spirit to things. We make them come alive. I think it's an even bigger interaction if we become aware of this concept. I think synchronicity is basically, that's when the cup is starting to flow over a little bit. We're so far disconnected from it that even at this point, the universe is like hinting, knocking on our door, you know, look at this stuff over here or over here. But I think that we're missing a million, a billion things of these every day that are just screaming meaning and bigger connection between themselves every day. We just have to become aware to it and realize it.
Absolutely, because there's so much out there. And, you know, I feel like I'll probably never get to the complete understanding of everything, but it's a process that's always being expanded on. It's very dynamic, and it's the more I do it, the more that I learn, and the more I see how all of these wonderful people that taught us about the universe, like Hermes Trismegistus and all these people a long time ago, I keep finding how that as they talk about this over and over again, how everything I'm finding falls right in line with what they're saying. And I begin to start seeing the parallels across the various religions and the various philosophies and things like that. And the more that I do this, the better understanding that I get, but it's always a constant learning process.
Indeed. Where are you heading next? Are you continuing down this rabbit hole, or are there other areas that you want to look into next, Danny?
Well, right now I'm continuing to look at the details beyond the around the physical aspects that I'm seeing out there that tie this area to some kind of a brain or a mind or something like that. Beyond that, I never really do much heavy planning for the future. The things seem to just come in waves when they decide to come. And
yeah, that's right.
And so whenever it hits me, or whenever I see something or I have an epiphany, it takes me down a path. It's almost as if a lot of times that I'm being handed things. Here, look at this. Here, look at this. And then all of a sudden I look at it, and then it just takes me down this path and expands upon it. So it almost kind of comes in waves and kind of unexpected, but it continues to happen over and over again. So who knows where it's going to take me, but it's been a wonderful experience, and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Excellent. Yeah, it's excellent to be on that ride, if you will, when things are just falling into your lap, and you're just kind of on a trail. But you, as you said, don't need to plan too much, because you're I think we become vessels for things that want to be known and realized in a larger context. And there's so many people that are doing this right now as well. They're looking into all kinds of little details, and then we we share those ideas and consequently get a bigger realization about our world, about our surrounding. And it literally is like that idea of the brain cell, kind of there is a certain point, I think, an embryo's life, if you will, where the amount of brain cells, when there is a certain amount of brain cell, that is actually when there is space for consciousness to begin to operate or take room of the tool that the brain is, if you will. And it's almost like we're at that point on Earth as well. I think there are more and more people individually that are like brain cells that are starting to become aware. And eventually, when the synapses gets flowing, as you kind of referenced earlier, Danny, about God and Adam, if you will, the greater realization is the Orion Nebula, God, that concept of the brain reaching down to man. And they're almost touching fingers, at this point, and that there is a kind of a spark that could come into this. And
I think we should add also that, that the ancient Egyptians also held the heart very high in regard. It's very important. And from the heart, you gained what's called the heart intelligence of the universe. And what that basically means is that I think there's a lot of physical ties that people are keep putting around the heart versus the brain. But in my opinion, what it actually means is that, what they did was they weighed the heart against the feather of truth.
Yeah.
And I think truth becomes extremely important in the whole equation. And when your heart is in the right place and you're looking for truth, it's almost that way. Then what actually happens is that with your heart being in the right place, then when you open up into your higher levels of consciousness between your left and right brain, they function efficiently and they work correctly because your heart is in the right place. And I think that's what my understanding about the heart is, because we can't really talk about how the heart thinks, whether it does or not. We can talk about how what the heart means and what truth means. And we can see that when you're in the right place in that area, how when your higher faculties between your right and left brain begin to function, they function with the direction that the heart is giving them. And in that way, you reach these higher levels of intelligence, I think.
Well, that's good. Exactly. We've talked about with people from the Heart Math Institute before, that the heart basically has a bigger micro voltage, I think, than the brain overall. It seems to be, it's definitely a dual system. And it's all, as you said before, it's all about the human body. The symbolic significance of the human body is that this is all parts that is out there in the universe around us. I guess the focus on the brain in this context would be that it's a tool for realizing, have a greater realization or something. So maybe we're being sent the brain message first, if you will, and maybe there are heart symbols out there as well in other nebulas. Who knows, huh?
Well, the Mayans, you know, interestingly, this area by the Mayans was called Heart of the Sky in the Popol Vuh. And so in the Popol Vuh, it said, and so Heart of Sky thinks, and that's what's inside the Popol Vuh. So Heart of Sky thinks. And this is how these areas were created, like the world was created by it thinking something. And so this is kind of how we look at all of this this information and kind of start making some sense of it. So this also in the very heart of the Orion constellation. So, yeah, it seems as though there's definitely a heart and mind connection that has to be done here. It's not all about the heart. It's not all about the mind. It's about a connection of the two that causes the higher... higher intelligence.
Indeed. Well, we're going to wrap up here in a minute or so. It's a fascinating book with a lot of new interesting ideas that indeed also connects with the work of many other researchers who have kind of been lingering around somewhat similar topics, line of thinking, but it goes into a new area that I haven't seen before. So I recommend everyone to check it out and learn more. And of course, the website, as Danny said before, orioninthevatican.com. That's the best place to go to check out the book and the additions of all the work that Dan is doing right now. But also tell us how people can connect to you on Facebook and YouTube, Danny.
Sure. So my name is Danny Wilton, W-I-L-T-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook if you just type that in. On every one of my videos on YouTube, if you go to YouTube, just type in Danny Wilton also. And in the description area, you'll always see a link to a public link to my Facebook album, which will take you right there to Facebook if you'd like to go that route. But Facebook and YouTube is the best way to reach me. Once again, orioninthevatican.com, you can get my e-book. And just to let everybody know that e-book is just a way of looking at the information in condensed form and a great way to start. But I will remind everybody that all of the information that is contained in there is also contained on YouTube and Facebook. So if you can't afford the ebook and in order to look at it in a condensed fashion, if you can just go through all my videos, or you can go through my photo album in Facebook as well, and you can find all of the same information. So all of the stuff is still out there for everybody to view regardless.
And the videos is a great addition, by the way. You have them linked up in the ebook version of it, and so that's a really good source. Sometimes you do need to kind of see the transitions and the imagery kind of connected in a video format. It just makes it so much more easier in certain regards. So good work on that.
Sure, thank you.
All right, well, thanks very much, Danny. Much appreciated. Keep up the good work, and hope we can do this another time.
Thanks, Henrik. I really appreciate you having me on.
And there it is, another radio program that I hope you've enjoyed listening to. Thank you for spending some of your time with us. We'll return with much more in just a few days. We have Robert Tindall, Russell Targ, and Lynn Picknett, among others, coming up on their program next. In the meantime, please feel free to explore our archives and the rest of the content that we have for you on redicemembers.com. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. We'll be back before you know it. Take it easy. Talk to you soon.